But as she drove on, she realized that he could not act to save himself for the same reason that she could not act to save him. Their dedication to the movement would not allow it. She had vowed to obey all orders, and Linsky, it seemed, had chosen to accept his fate. When they arrived in County Monaghan, just across the border, a group of men were waiting for them under a lamppost. Linsky thanked her for driving him and told her not to worry. He reached out and shook her hand. "I'll be seeing you, Joe," Price said. But she knew that she wouldn't be, and she cried the whole way home. 9. Orphans. One day in January 1973, a television crew from the BBC arrived at St. Jude's Walk. They were looking for the McConville children. Jean had been gone for more than a month. The local press had become aware of the story after an initial article was published in the newsletter of the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association. Under the headline, "Where is Jean McConville?" the article described how the widowed mother of 10 had been missing since the 7th of December, when she was unceremoniously removed from her home. Picking up on the original item, the Belfast Telegraph ran a short article on the 16th of January, "Snatched Mother Missing a Month," which noted that none of the children had reported the abduction of their mother to the police. The next day, the paper appealed for help in solving the mystery disappearance. The BBC crew discovered Helen and the younger children living alone in the flat. After the cameras had been set up, the children sat huddled on the sofa, framed by a backdrop of striped yellow wallpaper, and described their ordeal. Four young girls come into the kitchen. "They ordered all the kids up the stairs and they just walked in and took my mummy," Agnes said quietly. "Mummy walked out in the hall. She put on her coat and left." "What did your mummy say when she left?" the interviewer asked. "She had a big squeal," Agnes said. "Do you know why your mummy was taken away?" They didn't. Helen was a lovely-looking teenager, with the same pale and narrow face as her mother. Her dark hair swept to either side. She sat with Billy on her lap and nervously averted her eyes from the camera. The boys were fair and ginger. Tucker was sitting on Agnes's lap, wearing a blue turtleneck and shorts, though it was the dead of winter, revealing his knobbly knees. The kids were twitchy, their eyes roving all over the place. Michael sat to Helen's side, nearly cut out of shot. He stared at the camera, blinking. "Helen, I believe you're looking after the family," the reporter said. "How are you managing to cope?" "Okay. When do you think you'll see your mummy again?" "Don't know." "Nobody's been in touch with you at all?" Agnes mentioned that they had seen Granny McConville. "She must be a fairly old lady by now," the reporter said. "She's blind," Agnes said. Agnes was 13. She noted, hopefully, that her mother had been wearing red slippers when she was taken away. It was like an image from a fairy tale, a clue. Agnes said that the siblings would keep our fingers crossed and pray hard for her to come back. Granny McConville may have been part of the reason that the children had not reported Jean's disappearance to the police. She told people that she was afraid too, though she did not spell out precisely why. The children believed fervently that their mother would soon come home, but things began to look bleak. They were able to draw on Jean's pension, but where one might expect the close-knit community in Belfast to rally around and care for such a family, dropping by with a hot meal or assisting Helen with the children, nobody did. Instead, it was as if the whole community in Divis simply chose to ignore the flat full of abandoned children on St. Jude's Walk. It might simply have been that this was a time of crisis in Belfast and people had worries of their own, or there could have been some darker reason. But in any case, nearly everyone in the community simply looked the other way. A social worker did visit the children not long after Jean was taken. The authorities had received a call about a pack of siblings who had been looking after themselves. A bureaucrat created a new file and indicated that the children's mother appeared to have been abducted by an organization, shorthand for a paramilitary group. The social worker spoke with Granny McConville, who did not seem overly perturbed. According to notes from the meeting, Jean's mother-in-law asserted primly that Helen was a very capable girl and seemed to be managing with the children. Helen did not get along with Granny McConville any more than Jean had. No fondness there, the social worker wrote. This was not exactly a healthy environment for young children, and the social worker recommended putting them into care, turning them over to the state to be brought up at a group home. But the McConville children flatly refused. Their mother would be returning any day now, they explained. They needed to be at home when she got back. They held on to one another, marooned inside the flat. Bedtime was suspended and dishes piled up in the sink. The neighbours, rather than helped, started to complain to the authorities that they couldn't sleep at night because the children were making so much noise, with nobody to supervise them, and you could hear the racket through the walls. Even the Catholic Church declined to intervene. One report from the social worker, just a week before Christmas, noted that a local parish priest was aware of the children's predicament, but was unsympathetic. As other local children were composing Christmas lists, the McConvilles were running out of food. They didn't have much money coming in. Only Archie, who worked as an apprentice roof tailor, had a job. The children started getting into trouble. Michael would stay out late and shoplift food. Eventually he was caught, along with one of his brothers, stealing chocolate biscuits from a shop in town. Asked by the police why he had done it, he said he and his siblings had not eaten in several days. They were starving. Michael was 11 years old. When the authorities questioned the McConville kids about their parents, Jim told them, "My daddy is dead, and the IRA took my mummy away." There is no record in the files of the Royal Ulster Constabulary of any investigation into the disappearance of Jean McConville. She was abducted at the end of the most violent year of the conflict, and this sort of incident, horrible though it was, may not have risen to such a level that the police felt the need to concern themselves. A detective from Springfield Road Police Station did stop by the flat on the 17th of January, but the police were not able to offer any substantive clues and do not appear to have pursued the matter. Two local members of Parliament, when they discovered what had happened, decried the kidnapping as a callous act and appealed for help in finding Jean. But nobody came forward with information. Belfast could sometimes feel more like a small town than a city. Even before the Troubles, the civic culture of the place was clotted with unsubstantiated gossip. Almost as soon as Jean McConville had disappeared, rumours began to circulate that she had not been kidnapped at all, that, on the contrary, she had absconded of her own free will, abandoning her children to shack up with a British soldier. The children, who were already seized with worry, became aware of these stories. They would hear people whispering, feel the hot glare of judgment when they saw their neighbours in the shop or on the street. Back at the flat, some of them would wonder aloud if it could be true. Could she really have left them? It didn't seem possible. But how else to explain the fact that she had not returned? Archie McConville would later conclude that all that pernicious whispering amounted to more than just salt in the wound. It was a kind of poison, he decided, an attempt to wreck our minds. One byproduct of the Troubles was a culture of silence. With armed factions at war in the streets, an act as innocent as making inquiries about a vanished loved one could be dangerous. One day, that February, a posse of boys from the youth wing of the IRA seized Michael McConville. They took him to a room where they tied him up and stabbed him in the leg with a penknife. They let him go with a warning. "Don't talk to anyone about what happened to your mother." The interlude of freedom did not last. By February, social services had initiated the process of relocating the children to orphanages. One day, three women turned up at the flat and declared that they had been granted tenancy and were ready to move in. This was happening all the time in Belfast. A cruel expediency of wartime. It was like an awful game of musical chairs. No sooner was one family uprooted than another uprooted family would take their home. The children refused to leave, but the state had decided, and ultimately, the kids were made wards of court. The act of disappearing someone, which the International Criminal Court would eventually classify as a crime against humanity, is so pernicious in part because it can leave the loved ones of the victim in a purgatory of uncertainty. The children held out hope that they had not been orphaned and that their mother might suddenly reappear. Perhaps she had developed amnesia and was living in another country, unaware that she had left a whole life behind in Belfast. But even then, there was reason to believe that something terrible had happened to Jean McConville. About a week after she was kidnapped, a young man whom the children did not know had come to the door of the flat and handed them their mother's purse and three rings she had been wearing when she left. Her engagement ring, her wedding ring, and an eternity ring that Arthur had given her. Desperate for information, the children asked where Jean was. "I don't know anything about your mother," the man said. "I was just told to give you these." Years later, Michael McConville would look back and isolate that encounter as the moment he realized that his mother must be dead. 10. The Freds. One autumn day in 1972, a laundry van pulled into the Twinbrook estate on the outskirts of Belfast, and Sarah Jane Wark got out and walked up to one of the houses. The van was a regular presence in the neighbourhood. There were not a lot of shops in the area, so it was common to see traders going door to door offering their wares. The company was called Four Square Laundry, and once a week Sarah would come to the door, pick up a pile of dirty laundry, and then return it, clean and neatly folded, several days later. People liked the service. The prices were cut rate. And people liked Sarah, a pretty, ingratiating young woman. The driver, Ted Stewart, was a young man from County Tyrone, who mainly stayed behind the wheel. But he was an easy-going fella, and the local customers liked him too. The kids on the estate called him Teddy. Twinbrook was home to both Catholics and Protestants, but it was relatively calm by the standards of Belfast at the time. Sarah walked up to one of the residences. A housewife came to the door, and she and Sarah were exchanging a few words when suddenly they were interrupted by a loud cracking noise. Sarah spun round to see that two men had appeared. One of them held a machine gun, the other had a rifle. They were standing in a nimbus of smoke, crouched, with their backs to Sarah, spraying bullets from close range into the driver's side of the laundry van where Ted was sitting. Sarah stood frozen in the doorway, watching helplessly as Ted was killed. Then one of the gunmen turned in her direction. After the debacle of the internment raids, the British Army and the special branch of the Royal Ulster Constabulary had continued to focus with ever greater intensity on cultivating sources within both Loyalist and Republican paramilitary groups. Brendan Hughes started to develop a suspicion in 1972 that he might have an informant in D Company. His intelligence officer told him that a young volunteer, a former asphalt layer named Seamus Wright, had been arrested earlier in the year, and that ever since his arrest he would go missing from time to time. Wright, who was 25, had recently married, and Hughes paid a visit to his wife, Kathleen. She said that Seamus had been arrested in February and held by the British. But then he had telephoned a shop near her home and left a message for her, saying that he had scarpered, run away. Seamus was in England now, Kathleen continued. He was in Birmingham. She had an address. Hughes suggested that perhaps Kathleen should go there and see Seamus. he was enlisting the young bride of a suspected spy to serve as a spy herself. She would pay Seamus a visit and try to get him to return with her. Then she would report back to Brendan Hughes. Kathleen flew to England, but when she got there, Seamus refused to come home, so she returned alone and met Hughes at a house on Leeson Street. During this debriefing, Kathleen confirmed his worst fears. Seamus had been turned by the British, she said. When she saw her husband, he had been accompanied by an Englishman, some sort of handler. But there was a catch, she continued. Seamus wanted out. He planned to flee, to escape his handlers. He wanted a guarantee that if he came back to Belfast, he wouldn't be shot by the IRA. This was a bold proposal from someone who had violated the trust of the provost and gone into business with the enemy, a transgression that was generally punishable by death. But sensing an opportunity to learn how the British were going about their recruitment of double agents, Hughes consented and gave the guarantee. Not long afterwards, Seamus Wright returned to West Belfast, where he was interrogated in a house for 2 days. He explained that during his initial arrest by the British, they had told him that they could link him to an explosion that had killed a member of the security forces. They were so adamant that they had the goods on him that Seamus began to suspect he had been grassed, given up to the authorities by a supergrass, a paid informer. Once his handlers had secured his cooperation, they asked him about guns and explosives, but what they really wanted to know about was the Dirty Dozen. They told Seamus that if he would just give them the names of everyone in D Company, he would not be charged with any crime. Hughes was dismayed to discover that he had a traitor in his company, a traitor who had revealed the identities of the Dirty Dozen. One irony of the provost's pretense to being a legitimate army was that in those early days they were structured much like the British Army, with battalions and companies and a clear, legible chain of command. What this meant, in practice, was that if the enemy succeeded in turning someone, even a relatively junior player like Seamus Wright, they could discern the org chart of a large swathe of the organisation. After agreeing to be an informant, Wright said he was flown to England for training as a double agent. Then he was flown back to Northern Ireland with the understanding that he would now begin to gather intelligence on the provost. As Hughes listened intently, Wright described a secret compound at Palace Barracks where the army housed its prized informants. There was a clandestine unit inside the army, Wright said. They called it the MRF, and it managed both Republican and Loyalist informants. Wright explained that the army controlled a stable of individuals who had been induced to switch sides and were now working undercover for the British. The members of the MRF would show them newsreel footage of funerals and surveillance pictures of suspects, then ask them to pick out the people they knew. Sometimes Wright's handlers would load him into an armoured personnel carrier and drive into the falls. As they prowled through the narrow streets, Wright would peek through the vehicle's gun slits and identify the pedestrians they passed. The MRF had a name for this secret coterie of traitors. They called them the Freds. Nobody in the provost ever learned the source of the nickname, but there was no way to read the work of Brigadier Frank Kitson and not recognize that the Freds were a counter-gang. Now the eye slits in those white hoods that Kitson's Mau Mau informants wore back in Kenya had been replaced by the gun slits in a Saracen armored vehicle. Wright said that the compound where the Freds were kept was segregated, so he could not identify most of the other informants. But there was one he could name. "There is a guy I have seen in there," Wright said. "He's one of us." The man Wright named was a young provo, a boy really, a member of Ballymurphy Company named Kevin McKee. He was still a teenager, a handsome adolescent with big blue eyes, shaggy dark hair and a slight overbite. People called him Beaky. He had grown up in West Belfast and liked to sit in the front room of the family home listening to records on the old-fashioned radiogram. He joined the youth wing of the IRA, throwing stones at the British Army and the RUC. When loyalists would string a Union Jack on the telephone pole, Kevin would shimmy up and pull it down to cheers from the people below. He was a charismatic kid, caught up in the romance and intrigue of the Troubles. There was an innocence to him. But he also went on snipes, as sniping operations were known, and planted bombs. As one of his IRA contemporaries in Ballymurphy put it, he didn't lack balls. One night, Kevin McKee was arrested and hauled into Springfield Road Army Barracks. Two of his aunts ventured to the barracks to see what had happened to him, but when they arrived, they were told that he had escaped. Eventually, the family received letters from Kevin in England and assumed that he must have moved there to hide from the army and the police. But the truth was, he had become an informant. A British army log from the night when he was arrested noted that after being taken into custody, he gave information about a particular property. The log then listed a series of weapons that were recovered from an IRA arms dump at the address. According to the log, McKee was arrested just before 11 p.m. and the house was searched just after midnight. So he must have flipped almost immediately. Seamus Wright told Hughes that McKee loved his involvement in the Freds, and the members of the military units in the MRF took a shine to the cocksure teenager. They liked his bravado. When Frank Kitson was recruiting captured Mau Mau in Kenya to work in counter-gangs, he found that they needed to be tamed in a process he described as if it were the breaking of a horse. He avoided fanatical believers who were too difficult to bring across to the other side and focused instead on recruiting people who had joined the movement for a reason that was essentially social, because their friends were joining. In one of his books, Kitson noted that the very best recruits were the ones with a spirit of adventure, people who thought that it would be fun to be a gangster and carry a pistol. They were the easiest to handle because they were the easiest to satisfy. In Kenya, these were the types of recruits to whom Kitson would give his own gun, letting them carry it on patrol to indulge their sense of adventure and make them feel like a trusted part of the team. In Belfast, the MRF gave Kevin McKee a pistol and a shoulder holster, which he wore around, flaunting the costume as if he were a Chicago gangster. As a Fred, he was entitled to carry the weapon and make use of the firing ranges on the army base. McKee was wearing the shoulder holster when the provost tracked them down. Under interrogation, he confessed to his betrayal, just as Seamus Wright had. But now, the provost found themselves in an interesting position. On the one hand, they had identified two defectors who had betrayed the organization by agreeing to work with the British. Normally, they would have been court-martialed, found guilty, shot in the back of the head, then dumped by the side of the road. But the British did not appear to know that Hughes had discovered this breach in the IRA security, and Wright and McKee would do anything now to save their own lives. If their confessions were to be believed, the British Army had orchestrated an elaborate spy operation targeting the provost, yet the precise dimensions and operational details of that effort remained unclear. So Hughes was presented with an opportunity. Rather than execute Wright and McKee, he could use them to gather intelligence on the British as triple agents. For Wright and McKee, such a move might be risky, but it was preferable to the alternative of a speedy execution. Wright actually went back to work for the Freds with instructions this time to provide his British handlers with only low-level information, or better still, misinformation. Asked to identify a provo on a street corner, Wright would tell the British he was a sticky instead. This was a dangerous game. If the army discovered the deception, Wright could be sent to jail. He could also be shot by the MRF, which had shown little compunction about the occasional extrajudicial killing. But by demanding that Wright and McKee supply him with intelligence, Hughes was offering each man an opportunity to earn his life back. If they could deliver for the IRA, Hughes promised them they would be granted immunity for their initial crime. The men delivered. What they described to Hughes was an extensive intelligence gathering network that the British had developed around Belfast. The centerpiece of the operation was a laundry service, with an office in the city centre. Four Square Laundry operated an actual door-to-door laundry service, picking up clothing and linens, and then subcontracting to an industrial laundry in Belfast to wash the clothes. But before they got there, the clothes were analysed by British authorities. Traces of explosives could be detected on garments in order to determine whether bombs were being made or stored at a property. Analysts could also compare the clothing being picked up at a given residence with the number, age and gender of the people ostensibly living there. A mismatch might indicate that it was an arms drop or a call house. The laundry van had been specifically configured with a hollow roof in which a soldier could conceal himself, snapping photos of people and houses outside through a hidden opening. As soon as Hughes learned about the laundry operation, he wanted to sweep in and upend it. But Jerry Adams cautioned him to hold off. "Sit back," Adams said. "Do more intelligence." Hughes and his men learned that in addition to the laundry service and the office in the city centre, the MRF was operating a massage parlour above a house on the Antrim Road, where customers would sometimes find themselves so blissfully relaxed that they casually disclosed things to a chatty masseuse. By early October, Hughes and his team decided that they had gathered enough intelligence. It was time to move. They couldn't hit these locations one by one. As soon as they attacked the first one, the MRF would know the whole operation was blown, so the provos would launch three near simultaneous attacks on the van, the office and the massage parlour. The objective was to wipe out the whole intelligence gathering apparatus in the space of a single hour. The man behind the wheel of the Four Square Laundry van, Ted Stewart, was an undercover British sapper with the Royal Engineers. Ever since childhood, he had wanted to be a soldier. He was 20 and had been serving in Northern Ireland only since June. As the Provo hit team fired on the van, he died almost instantly. When the gunman turned on Stewart's partner, Sarah Jane Wark, she plunged into the house of the local woman she had been talking to. Wark was also an undercover soldier, a member of the Women's Royal Army Corps. She pulled the woman and her children in with her, and thinking quickly, told them that this must be a loyalist ambush. The women helped Wark scuttle out of the back door and escape. The gunman had orders not just to kill the young pair who operated the laundry service, but to strafe the ceiling of the van with bullets in order to kill the soldier inside. In their haste or panic, however, they did not do so, and if there was a third soldier concealed in the van, he escaped alive. Elsewhere in Belfast, another team of gunmen shot up the massage parlour and a third shot up the office, though neither managed to hit any other members of the MRF. The Four Square Laundry operation marked a major victory for the Provos. Hughes was proud of how it had played out, and in a memoir decades later, Jerry Adams would call it a devastating blow to the British. The question now was what to do with Wright and McKee. On the day of the Four Square operation, Wright came home and told his wife Kathleen that he would have to be careful, because before his release by the British, he had signed some papers relating to the Official Secrets Act. Then, that night, he disappeared. A car drove up to his family's door on Bombay Street. Wright exchanged a few words with the driver, got into the passenger seat, and was driven off. When he did not return, Kathleen went to Leeson Street to ask the provos what had become of him. They told her that he had not been taken by the IRA. After hearing that, Kathleen became convinced that her husband might have been snatched by the army, but the army too denied any involvement in his abduction. Military sources suggested to the press that Wright could have run off on his own and might be hiding out in Scotland. At around the same time, McKee vanished as well. One of his aunts had told him, "The IRA's been looking for you." "I've done nothing wrong," McKee replied, confident as ever. When he disappeared, the family chose not to contact the police. The authorities would probably be more harm than help. but there were rumours that McKee had gone off to art school, that someone had spotted him in England. The truth was that both men had been taken by the IRA. They had played their final card by giving the information on the MRF and the Four Square Laundry. The moment the simultaneous raids were complete, Wright and McKee no longer possessed any leverage. Brendan Hughes may have assured them that they had immunity, but this was not really an assurance he was authorized to give. By initially betraying the provost, they had committed an unforgivable sin, one that was not diminished by their subsequent work as triple agents. The unknowns were summoned, and Dolores Price drove both men across the border to the Republic. It was just Price driving the two of them. She had a particular loathing for informers. She had been brought up to revile them. But if she felt contempt for Wright and McKee, she kept it hidden, and on the drive south they were relaxed. After the success of the Four Square Laundry operation, they believed that they had earned their lives back. Someone had told Wright and McKee that they were going for a week of R&R across the border. "You're just going to get a rest and get your strength back," Price assured them. As far as she knew, it was true, though she had her suspicions to the contrary. In any case, she had her orders. In Monaghan, she dropped them off with the local unit. McKee ended up in a house in County Monaghan, which belonged to the family of a dead IRA man, Fergal O'Hanlon, who had been killed in the 1950s and had become the subject of a famous ballad, The Patriot Game. He was obliged to wait for a period of time so that some senior leaders could come across the border for his court-martial. The people who were minding him grew fond of him. He was a good cook, a fun guy, a personality. At one point, McKee telephoned his mother from the home of a nearby priest and asked her to bring him a change of clothes. She and his aunts drove down, but when they arrived at the house, Kevin was gone. A man was there. "Take the clothes with you," he said. "He'll not be back." When it came time to execute Kevin McKee, the local volunteers who had been holding him hostage found themselves unable to shoot him. They had grown too fond of him. When Hughes heard about this, it seemed like a sort of Stockholm syndrome in reverse, the hostage taker gradually falling for the hostage. In their stead, a pair of dispassionate gunmen were sent from Belfast. Before the killing, they summoned a priest. This was not unusual. There were certain priests in that era who grew accustomed to the late-night phone call. They would be summoned outside by gruff men who were about to perform an execution and asked to deliver the last rites. The act of killing itself had a ritual character, a practiced choreography that would have been familiar to McKee. A bag is placed over your head. Your hands are bound behind your back. You kneel in the soft grass, then you flop forward when the bullet hits your brain. Brendan Hughes felt betrayed by the decision to disappear Wright and McKee. He had given them his word that they would not be killed. It would trouble him for the rest of his life. The Four Square operation might have been a success, but Hughes and Jerry Adams could hold off the army for only so long. One afternoon the following summer, in July 1973, Adams was heading to a meeting at a call house on the Falls Road. As officer commanding for Belfast, he met daily with Hughes, his operations officer, and a man named Tom Cahill, who handled the finances. July was a tricky time to be on the run in Belfast. Because it was the peak season for Loyalist marches, most Catholics who could afford to get out of town for a week or two chose this time of year to do it. With fewer people on the streets in Catholic neighbourhoods, it was harder to move around unnoticed. When he was about 50 yards from the call house, Adams hesitated, eyeing the building, observing the area for any signs of suspicious activity. He loitered there a minute, leaning on the bonnet of a parked car. Then he noticed that there was someone in the car, a businessman consulting some papers in the front seat. Adams gave a little wave. The man waved back. When he was convinced that the location had not been compromised, Adams crossed the street and entered the call house. Inside, he met up with Hughes and Cahill, but the men had not been talking long when there was a knock at the door. This was not in itself grounds for alarm. The British patrolled Republican neighbourhoods, and it was standard to knock on the door and ask for a look around or a chat. They might not realise the significance of the house that they happened to stumble upon. A hasty decision was made. Cahill would answer the door while Hughes and Adams escaped out the back. But when they got into the yard, Hughes peered over the back wall and was startled to behold a sea of British troops. As soldiers flooded into the house, Adams casually pulled out some matches and lit his pipe. The businessman in the car that Adams had leaned on was not a businessman. While Adams did surveillance on the house, the man behind the wheel was doing surveillance on him. An ambitious operation had been planned, with soldiers secretly massing on the perimeter. But they had orders not to start the raid until both Adams and Hughes were inside the house. When Adams opened the front door, he triggered the operation. The provos were taken to a police station on Springfield Road, where they were beaten and tortured for hours. Adams was beaten so badly that he passed out. His captors doused him with a bucketful of water to revive him, then started beating him again. One of the interrogators, a tall man in a pinstriped suit, pulled out a pistol and put it to Hughes's head, then cocked it. He said that he was going to kill Hughes, then dump his body on the Black Mountain and say that the Loyalists had done it. The British forces were hugely pleased. In one swoop, they had caught several of their most high-profile targets, including Hughes, who had never been captured before. William Whitelaw, who had met Adams in London the summer before, came personally to congratulate the men involved and brought with him a load of champagne. The soldiers took turns posing for trophy photographs with the two captives, who had been so severely beaten that they could hardly walk. Even so, Hughes was defiant. "I'm going to escape," he told them. He and Adams were loaded into a Saracen and taken to a helicopter, which transported them on a short ride to Long Kesh. When the helicopter touched down, they were marched, handcuffed into the prison. As they were walking in, the whole place erupted in a massive cheer. To the Republican prisoners in Long Kesh, Adams and Hughes were iconic figures, celebrities. When they entered the heavily fortified installation, they were hailed as conquering heroes. Hughes would later count that moment, black and blue, manacled, born into prison on that great wave of enthusiasm, as one of the greatest in his life. Book 2. Human Sacrifice. 11. Close England. The crocuses were already in bloom around London's parks and monuments on the 8th of March 1973. It was a Thursday, a crisp, crystalline early spring morning. After a wet English winter, people were venturing outdoors, beckoned by the sun. The Queen left Buckingham Palace to inspect the first blooms in her garden. There was a rail strike that day, and with train services suspended, commuters were forced to drive into the city. As a result, central London was overrun with cars. In order to accommodate the surge of vehicles, the city had suspended parking restrictions for the day. Cars were everywhere, in loading zones and other areas that were usually off-limits, or at meters that had long since expired. Just after lunchtime, at around 2 p.m, a phone rang at the headquarters of the Times in London. A young woman named Elizabeth Curtis, who had just started working on the news desk at the paper, picked up the call. She heard a man's voice, speaking very quickly, with a thick Irish accent. At first she couldn't make out what he was saying, then she realised that he was reeling off the descriptions and locations of a series of cars. He spoke for just over a minute, and though she was still confused, she transcribed as much as she could. Before hanging up, the man said, the bombs will go off in 1 hour. A journalist named Martin Huckerby was on duty that day in the newsroom. He overheard Curtis dictating details about the bombs to one of her colleagues. The nearest of the locations she mentioned was the Old Bailey, the Central Criminal Court in London, just a short walk from the Times. Huckerby bolted out of the office. He was looking for a green Ford Cortina estate with a number plate that, assuming Curtis had transcribed it correctly, read YNS649K. Huckerby left the office at 2 p.m. and arrived at the monumental stone courthouse a few minutes later. Built at the turn of the century, the Old Bailey had been the site of many celebrated trials. A great dome sat atop the heavy masonry, with a bronze figure of justice, her arms outstretched, holding a sword and a set of scales. Dozens of cars were parked around the building, and Huckerby began checking them to see if he could find the Cortina. Before long, he spotted it, parked right in front of the courthouse, a green Cortina estate with the license plate YFN469K, close enough to what he was looking for, that he was sure this was it. Peering into the car's interior, he saw a pair of black gloves on the floor and an aerosol can. Huckerby waited for the police to come, and eventually, after what seemed like an eternity, two uniformed officers arrived at 2:33 and inspected the Cortina. They started evacuating people in the area, cordoning off the street. Huckerby took cover in a doorway about 25 yards from the Cortina and waited. The plan to bring the bombing campaign to England had been, at least in part, Dolores Price's idea. The IRA had detonated hundreds of bombs in commercial centres throughout Northern Ireland. If the goal was to cripple the economy, this effort had been a success. But the collateral damage was considerable. For civilians in Northern Ireland, whether Catholic or Protestant, the routine bombings could make life impossible. Suddenly you were taking your life into your hands when you went to the shop for a dozen eggs. It might not have been the intention of the IRA to cause civilian casualties, but there were civilian casualties, lots of them, and they were borne by Catholics and Protestants alike. Bloody Friday was an especially grave debacle, but it was hardly unique. Countless smaller bombing operations had claimed limbs and lives, steadily eroding support among moderate Irish nationalists for a violent campaign. Worst of all, because the toll of all this bombing was largely confined to Northern Ireland, it did not appear to be registering all that strongly with the intended target, the British. The English public, removed on the other side of the Irish Sea, seemed only dimly aware of the catastrophe engulfing Northern Ireland. It was a case study in strategic insanity. The Irish were blowing up their own people in a misguided attempt to hurt the English, and the English hardly even noticed. It bothered Price. "This is half their war," she would say to wee Pat McClure, the head of the Unknowns, as they sat around call houses between operations. "Only half of it is our war. The other half is their war, and some of it should be fought on their territory." She became convinced that a short, sharp shock, an incursion into the heart of the Empire, would be more effective than 20 car bombs in any part of the north of Ireland. After making the case to Sean McStaffin, who approved the idea, Price worked with McClure and Gerry Adams on an initial plan to firebomb London. The firebombs were made and smuggled into London, and the idea was that a team of girls would fly over and deposit them in department stores on Oxford Street. But before they could put the bombs in place, they discovered that the acid in the devices had leaked, ruining them. So Price, who was already in London, abandoned the mission and walked down to the banks of the Thames, where she gently slid each faulty bomb into the river. When firebombs didn't work, they resolved to plant car bombs instead. The idea took shape within the Belfast Brigade. When it came time to recruit a team for the mission, volunteers from different units assembled at a call house in the Lower Falls. Gerry Adams explained that they were planning a very dangerous job. Any volunteers who signed up for it would have to be away from home for a while. As Adams spoke, Price sat perched on the arm of his chair. In the interests of operational security, Adams was vague about the mission when he spoke to this larger group, offering few details, but he stressed that anyone who participated must be prepared to face the full wrath of the state. "This could be a hanging job," he said. "If anyone doesn't want to go, they should up and leave now." He instructed them to exit through the back door at 10-minute intervals so as not to attract attention. Price thought Adams was being melodramatic. She suspected he might have picked up that flourish about 10-minute intervals from a book about Michael Collins. But sure enough, people started to get up and walk out. "Don't knock me down in the rush, lads," Price said dryly. When the small exodus had concluded, about 10 people remained. There was Price's friend and fellow unknown, Hugh Feeney. He was erudite, bespectacled, in his early 20s. Feeney would be the quartermaster, in charge of all the money for the operation. He was armed with a thick roll of 5-pound notes. There was Jerry Kelly, a handsome young man from the Lower Falls, whom Price was meeting for the first time. Kelly had been on the run after escaping from prison, where he was serving a sentence for bank robbery. Price thought he was a grand lad. And then there was Marion, of course. There was always Marion. They were all very young. Kids, really. The oldest member of the crew, William Armstrong, a window cleaner with slicked back hair, was 29. The youngest member was Roisin McNairney, a wide-eyed 18-year-old. She had been working as a typist before she joined the Provo 6 months earlier. She still lived with her parents. As head of the unknowns, Wee Pat wanted smart people running the operation, so he selected Dolores to take the lead. She was appointed, in her own words, the OC of the whole shebang. Reporting to her would be two lieutenants, Hugh Feeney and Marion Price. None of the recruits had any experience serving behind enemy lines, so Wee Pat arranged for them to go across the border for intensive training with explosives and timers.
As Aunt Bridie could testify, bomb-making in the IRA was a hazardously inexact science. Brendan Hughes would tell stories about his great-grandfather, who during the War of Independence was trying to throw a grenade at an armoured car when it detonated and blew his arm off. Bomb-making had improved dramatically in recent years because the provost had taken every opportunity to practice. It was not that the IRA volunteers no longer blew themselves up with their own bombs, which they continued to do. Rather, as one writer observed, these mishaps came to function as a gruesome form of natural selection, weeding out the incompetent bombsmiths. Those who survived took greater care, and eventually the provost produced some legendary bomb makers. They developed a 50-page illustrated manual, which apprentice explosive specialists could study. It provided instructions on how to make booby traps using a remarkable variety of household utensils, candle wax, clothes pegs, a nail bomb made from a beer can, a drinking straw used as a fuse. The car bomb, which was first introduced to the conflict in early 1972, represented a terrifying departure, because up to that point, the size of most bombs had been limited by the sheer weight of explosives that a few paramilitaries could carry. Hiding the bomb inside a vehicle meant that you could prepare a massive payload, then simply drive the device to the target and walk away. Whereas a suitcase or a plastic bag left in a busy shop might attract attention, cars were the perfect camouflage, because they were everywhere. The car bomb provided an efficient container and an efficient delivery system, Sean McStephen wrote in 1975. It yielded far greater administrative, industrial, and economic damage for a given operation, and it required fewer volunteers to place it on the target. In the streets of Belfast, an empty, unattended car became all by itself a source of terror that could prompt people to flee the area and authorities to descend whether the car actually contained a bomb or not. In February, six cars were hijacked at gunpoint in Belfast and driven to the Republic. By the time the cars re-emerged on the streets of Dublin in early March, they had been repainted and equipped with false number plates. Ultimately, only four of the cars would make the journey to England. A Ford Corsair, a Hillman Hunter, a Vauxhall Viva, and the green Ford Cortina. Each was carefully fitted with a mammoth incendiary device. More than 100 pounds of pyre explosives hidden in plastic bags, along with a sausage of gelignite. Each payload was concealed beneath the rear seat and was connected by a length of detonating cord to a box under the front passenger seat that contained a timer fashioned from a household alarm clock. About a month before the operation, Dolores Price had travelled to London on a scouting mission along with Martin Brady, a muscular member of her team with bushy eyebrows who had worked previously at a restaurant in the West End and knew his way around the city. The unknowns had selected the targets themselves before presenting them to the leadership in Belfast for approval. The targets were carefully chosen to evoke particular political questions, Gerry Kelly later explained. The British public may have become inured to catastrophic headlines from Northern Ireland, but a series of bombs in central London would change all that. Nor was the timing of the operation an accident. They selected the day of a referendum in Northern Ireland on whether the territory should remain part of the United Kingdom. The mission, Kelly felt, was to bring the reality of colonialism home to England. On the 5th of March, the group split into two teams. Hugh Feeney led the first team across the Irish Sea, driving the Cortina and the Viva onto the Dublin-Liverpool ferry. The next day, a second team led by Marion Price drove the Corsair and the Hillman Hunter. But when the ferry reached Liverpool and their cars were passing through customs, the Hunter was held up. There seemed to be a problem with the number plate. Martin Brady was behind the wheel, while the young Roisin McNairney sat in the back. The inspectors appeared suspicious that they might be trying to bring a foreign car from the Republic of Ireland into the United Kingdom without paying any import tax. As they spoke, McNairney was fidgeting in the back seat, increasingly nervous. She announced that she needed to use the toilet and got out of the car. When she returned a few minutes later, the inspector, who had been questioning Brady, was called away to deal with a lorry that was impeding the flow of traffic. The young IRA members stayed where they were, unsure what the inspector might do when he came back. But now they were holding up traffic themselves, and another customs official impatiently waved them through. According to the original plan, the two remaining stolen cars were supposed to follow on another ferry, bringing the total number of bombs to six, but after the scare at customs, the team sent a message back to Ireland instructing their colleagues not to send the last two cars, in case the authorities had been tipped off. As the leader of the group, Dolores Price did not take the ferry. She flew from Dublin under an assumed name, Una Devlin. By Wednesday, 7th of March, the whole crew had filtered into London, left the cars with their hazardous cargoes in public garages and checked into different hotels. The plan was simple. Early the following morning, the team would drive the cars into position at four locations in the city: a British Army recruiting centre in Whitehall, the British Forces Broadcasting Service on Dean Stanley Street, New Scotland Yard, and the Old Bailey. A telephone warning would be issued in advance. Mindful of the disastrous civilian toll on Bloody Friday, the team had been given orders to avoid casualties. The warnings would be initiated just before 2 p.m. local time, and precisely 1 hour later, the alarm clock timers would trigger the detonations. By that time, Price and the others would already be back in Ireland, having returned to Dublin on a late morning flight from Heathrow. On Wednesday, after they had all checked into their hotels, members of the team did reconnaissance on the locations. "You don't know each other," Price told them. "You've never seen each other before. When you meet each other on the street," she added emphatically, that there should be no drink involved. Before sunset, Price assembled everyone in the portico of the National Gallery in Trafalgar Square to finalize arrangements and to hand out plane tickets for the following day. Then they had the night off. You might suppose that on the eve of a coordinated terrorist strike on a major city, the participants would devote the final hours to anxious preparation. On account of their youth, perhaps, or the almost hallucinatory fever of their own righteousness, Price and her compatriots seemed eerily detached from the gravity and potential consequences of the mission they were about to undertake. Besides, they were in London, a city more vast and freewheeling than their own. The heart of empire it may have been, but London was also indisputably a fun town. So the young terrorists went sightseeing. Roisin McNairney paid a visit to Buckingham Palace. Some of the men defied Price's admonition and went out and got drunk. So drunk that one of them would have to be carried out of the pub. Price, who was more high-minded, went to the theatre along with Marion. Hugh Feeney ended up joining them but arrived late because he wanted to carry out one final check on the car bombs. It did not strike any of them as the least bit incongruous that they might go and see a play on the night before a bombing. On the contrary, Feeney felt that should something go awry the next morning, it might be a while before they had a chance to see any good theatre. As it happened, their visit to London coincided with a production at the Royal Court of The Freedom of the City, a new play by the Irish playwright Brian Friel. The play, which was directed by Albert Finney, told a story that was fictional but highly topical, a story that could only have resonated with Dolores Price. Three civil rights protesters seek refuge from gas and rubber bullets in the Guildhall in Derry, the same hall where Ian Paisley and Major Bunting whipped up their followers the night before the ambush on the march at Burntollet Bridge. The play turns on a misunderstanding. While the peaceful protesters hole up inside the Guildhall, on the outside, the press and the British Army come to assume that they are actually terrorists engaged in an armed occupation. The play was inspired in part by Bloody Sunday, which Brian Friel had witnessed personally. It was about the hysteria, the myth-making and the misunderstanding that had twisted the peaceful civil rights movement in Northern Ireland into a violent conflagration. The three marchers ultimately die in the play, shot by the British troops. In an echo of the cover-up following Bloody Sunday, a tribunal is assembled to investigate and concludes that the shooting was justified. This was delicate material for a London audience, and crowds for the show had been sparse and notably uneasy. One of the three leads in the production, a young actor named Stephen Ray, later remarked that it had been received by London audiences in a frost of ignorance. Though he was an emerging star at the Royal Court, Ray was a Belfast native, a beguiling-looking young man with soft features, quizzical eyes and a shock of black hair that always looked recently slept on. As it happened, he and Dolores Price knew each other. Ray had studied at Queen's, and they had met during the civil rights movement in the late 1960s. They ended up falling out of touch as she joined the Provos and he became a prominent actor, performing roles in Dublin and Edinburgh before joining the company at the Royal Court. But here Dolores Price was, about to bomb London, watching this dashing, intelligent, intriguing young man play the part of a civil rights marcher who gets mistaken for a member of the IRA. The bombers had arranged for wake-up calls before dawn. They rose, dressed, checked out of their hotels, then went to retrieve the cars and drive them into position while good parking spaces were still available. The real strike had created ideal circumstances for a car bombing, because parking rules were suspended, vehicles that might normally have been towed away were being left alone by the police. All four cars were driven to their destinations, the Hillman to the Army Recruiting Office, the Corsair to New Scotland Yard, the Vauxhall to British Forces Broadcasting Service, and the Cortina to the Old Bailey. By 7:30, the bombs were in place, with their timer set to detonate at 2:50 that afternoon. Just after 10 a.m., most of the crew caught a bus from Cromwell Road to Heathrow, where they were to catch the 11:20 plane to Dublin. The Price sisters and Hugh Feeney were scheduled to take a slightly later flight. The officers of London's Metropolitan Police rose early that day as well. At 7 a.m., just as the bombers were navigating their cars into position, the Special Patrol Group received a briefing at Cannon Row Police Station in Westminster about an impending IRA attack. The officers were instructed to go out and look for suspicious vehicles. In particular, they were ordered to check in the vicinity of likely targets such as government buildings. The rail strike compounded the challenge. At the very moment when they needed as few vehicles as possible in central London, there was instead a tremendous influx. Later that morning, a couple of constables were patrolling the area around Scotland Yard when they noticed a green Corsair with no tax disc. As they examined the vehicle, they discovered that it was a 1968 model but had 1971 plates. They noticed another anomaly. Whereas a number plate normally had two drill holes in it, this one had four. Peering through the windows, the officer spotted a thin, white cord snaking from the front seat to the back, partially hidden under the carpet on the floor. A team of bomb disposal experts were summoned. They discovered nearly 200 pounds of explosives packed beneath the rear seat. It was, in the assessment of one of the investigators, a monstrous, tremendously powerful bomb. The interior of the Corsair reeked of explosives, and the timer in its box was audibly ticking. One of the bomb experts looked up and saw that the windows of the surrounding buildings were filled with the faces of people looking down, watching them work. "Get those stupid bastards away from the windows," he shouted. One member of the bomb squad held the cord to the timing device while his partner gingerly severed it. It didn't blow. They had defused the bomb. Examining the position of the hour hand on the timer, the investigators deduced that it would have detonated around 3 p.m., though it was hard to say for certain because the minute hand on the clock had been removed. They realized two things immediately. One was that if there were other bombs hidden in the city, they had to find them before 3 p.m. The other was that the long fuse on the timer indicated that the bombers might be trying to flee the country before the blast. A bulletin was sent to special branch officers at every port and airport. Close England. Lock down all the exit points. Question any Irish people looking to leave. In trying to explain how the police had managed to be so far ahead of the bombers, British authorities would later make it sound as though they had simply been brilliantly lucky. But it was also suggested in the press that the police in London may have had prior notice that an attack was coming, and that it would involve more than one bomb. The Price sisters, for their part, would always believe that the operation had been betrayed by an informant. Hugh Feeney shared their suspicion, declaring later, "We were set up." They were right. Decades after the bombing mission, a retired special branch officer would reveal that he had been tipped off 14 hours before the bombs were set to blow and that his source had been a senior member of the Provisionals. The officer knew in advance that there would be four bombs rather than six. He also knew that the bombing team would include a young provo named Jerry Kelly and two sisters named Price. Even so, as the police fanned across central London in search of the other three bombs, the city looked like one big car park, completely clogged with stationary vehicles. They searched frantically for anything suspicious, but having no clue as to the rough locations, they were unable to locate any of the other cars. The bombs could literally be anywhere. Just before 2 p.m, the warning call was received at the Times, spelling out the locations and descriptions of the cars. But even then, there was a miscommunication within the police department, which caused a delay in getting officers to the scenes of the three remaining bombs. Martin Huckerby, the Times reporter, beat the police to the Cortina outside the Old Bailey by more than 20 minutes, and additional precious minutes ticked by before the bomb squad arrived and the officers began running into surrounding buildings to evacuate people. Inside the Old Bailey itself, several criminal trials were underway. A drug conspiracy case was wrapping up in one courtroom. A judge was addressing the jury for a murder trial in another. Someone burst into the courtrooms and told everyone to get out. A bomb was about to go off right outside the building. A pub called The George, which stood opposite the courthouse, was full of patrons nursing afternoon pints when somebody ran in and shouted that there was a bomb in the street. Some of the customers simply moved deeper into the pub, crowding the back bar, but others looked out at the serene, sunny afternoon and, thinking this could only be a hoax, decided to stay put. London had not experienced any serious bombings since the Blitz 3 decades earlier. It was as if people could not imagine the idea. Some gawkers pressed their faces against the windows to watch the bomb squad work. The technicians were trying to defuse the bomb, but without success, and the timer in the front seat kept ticking. As 3 o'clock approached, the police were still struggling to clear the area when a school bus rolled up, not 50 yards from the Cortina. Inside the bus were 49 school children on a field trip to visit St. Paul's Cathedral. As the hand on the timer ticked towards 3, the children began to disembark. Most of the bombing team were on a bus to Heathrow when the BBC put out a report about the first bomb being discovered and defused. The bombers did not hear the bulletin, so they arrived at the airport unaware that they were now the subject of a manhunt. As far as they knew, the mission was proceeding as planned, and they were about to return unnoticed to Ireland. They arrived at Terminal 1, headed to Gate 4, and presented their tickets for the British European Airways flight to Dublin, which was due to depart at 11:20. Several of the bombers had actually filed onto the plane and taken their seats when officials entered and instructed everyone to get off. Dolores, Marion and Hugh Feeney were scheduled to take an Aer Lingus flight at 12:30. By the time they arrived at Heathrow, the rest of the team was supposed to be in the air. But when they entered the terminal, special branch officers were waiting. "Are you flying to Dublin?" one of the officers asked. "Would you mind coming with me?" They were taken into custody and ushered into a holding area for questioning. But because the plan had been predicated on the idea that the team would be out of the country before any bombs were discovered, none of the volunteers had concocted any sort of cover story that was remotely convincing. Some claimed they had come to London in search of work. Others said they had been staying on the Belgrave Road and had got drunk at a local pub, which at any rate had elements of the truth. They all offered false names. Dolores stuck with her pseudonym Una Devlin and denied that they knew one another. Asked about the bombs, they responded with sullen silence. What the authorities did not know then, but would learn later, was that one member of the group, an 11th bomber, was missing. He had slipped away before the others were arrested at the airport and gone to ground in London. He has never been identified or captured. "I don't intend to tell you anything," Marion Price said when she was questioned by a senior police officer. "You've no right to keep me here." She continued to stonewall, refusing to say a thing. It was already after 2 p.m. and the detectives knew they were running out of time. They pressed Marion about where the other bombs were, but she would not say. She wore a locket around her neck, and she kept putting it in her mouth and chewing on it anxiously. It suddenly occurred to the chief inspector, who was interviewing her, that the locket might contain some kind of poison, like a cyanide pill. He snatched it from her, only to see that it was a crucifix. His frustration growing, the inspector called her an evil little maniac and said she would not be seeing the sunshine again for some time. But Marion Price said nothing. There was something robotic, almost trance-like, about her demeanour, and that of her fellow bombers. The detectives began to wonder if they had undergone some instruction in how to resist interrogation. They would fix their eyes on an object and just stare at it, as if hypnotized, refusing to say a thing. Then, just before 3 p.m., Marion raised her wrist and looked pointedly at her watch. In a quiet fury, the chief inspector said, "Am I intended to gather that the timing on the other bombs has just expired?" Marion Price just smiled. In Whitehall, people were ambling back from lunchtime in the pleasant weather when the police finally discovered the Hillman Hunter packed in front of the Army Recruiting Centre. The officer stormed into the surrounding buildings, clearing everybody out. With 5 minutes to go before detonation, an explosives expert from the Royal Army Ordnance Corps broke a window and climbed into the car, then attempted to disarm the device. But there wasn't time now, and he scrambled out. Using a hook attached to a long line, he snagged the detonating cord connecting the timer to the explosives, then took cover around the corner of a building and started to pull. The resistance was significant, so he asked a sergeant who was with him for help. The two of them had just started pulling on the cord again when the timer's hand reached its terminus. The Hillman split apart, ripped open by a sheet of flame that rose 40 feet in the air. There was a dull thud, and a reverberation so strong that it lifted people in the surrounding area clean off the pavement. Windows shattered in the offices and shops for a quarter of a mile around. The blast blew the helmets off the policemen's heads and sent tiny missiles of glass and metal whizzing in every direction. A sooty mushroom cloud rose above the street, and acrid smoke billowed among the buildings. A gas main ruptured, spewing more smoke and starting a blaze as firemen arrived and began dragging hoses through the carnage. People staggered about, dazed, their skin lacerated by glass. Dozens of cars were hollowed out and twisted up like crumpled paper. The clap of the blast echoed throughout central London. On Dean Stanley Street, authorities had just managed to find and dismantle the third bomb in the Vauxhall Viva, in front of the British Forces Broadcasting Service building. But by the time police had identified the car at the Old Bailey, it was too late. An officer ran towards the school bus and shouted at the children, who had just got off, telling them to run for their lives. They did, screaming and shouting, hurrying around a corner for cover. A police photographer was taking pictures of the car when suddenly he was hurled across the street. The blast was enormous. The facade of the George pub was torn away, exposing the lounge as if it were a room in a doll's house. A police officer was evacuating jurors from the Old Bailey when the blast threw him 20 feet. Another policeman was riding by on his bicycle when he was hurled against a wall, the force of the blast ripping away his uniform. Martin Huckerby, the Times journalist, was cut on his face and hands and taken to St. Bartholomew's Hospital.